Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Okay, and we're right on 6 o'clock, so thanks for coming on. Peter Beinart's here today as the courtesy of Melbourne University Press, so thanks to MUP for making this function possible. It's been podcast, and it'll go up on our pod. And of course, the paper will be published in due course in the Sydney papers. But now for the speech. Peter Beinart is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and in the Washington branch of the Council on Foreign Relations, and editor at large of the New Republic. Anne and I have subscribed for a long time, so we're familiar with his work over quite a few years. He also writes columns for Time magazine and for the Washington Post, and is a regular commentator on radio and television. And he lives in Washington, D.C., and he's in Australia on the occasion of the publication of his first and well-reviewed book, The Good Fight, Why Liberals and Only Liberals Can Win the War on Terror, meaning liberals in the American sense of the term. So, Peter, you're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, it's really a pleasure to be here at the Sydney Institute. The inspiration for this book, it has an unusual inspiration. The inspiration was George W. Bush and something that he said in the 2004 campaign, something that I think was actually quite crucial to him winning the 2004 campaign. He said it a lot. And what he said was, "You may not always agree with me, but at least you know where I stand," with the implication that you could not say the same about his Democratic opponent, John Kerry. And that line kind of haunted me in the days and weeks after the 2004 election, because it was so true. And it wasn't only true about George W. Bush and John Kerry. I think it's true about the left and the right in America more generally. One of the shocking experiments that you can do with young American college students, activists of the right and left, is if you turn to a group of conservative college activists and you say, "What is your intellectual history? What is your historical lineage? What are the books that have shaped what it means for you to be a conservative?" You get a catechism of books. You get a series of books and writers rattled off, recent, particularly American 20th century writers. Friedrich Hayek, Milton Friedman, William F. Buckley, Russell Kirk, James Burnham. I don't always know that the students, when you talk to them, have read those books, but they know of the books, and they have at least what we call a cliff notes. I don't know if they have cliff notes here. Version of what those books are. You ask a corresponding group of liberal activist students, left activist students, to name the book that was suggested that represents their intellectual tradition, by and large you get blank stares and then maybe a mention of someone's autobiography. Very, very little familiarity with the tradition, with the people who I think have created the 20th century American liberal tradition, people like Herbert Crowley, John Dewey, Reinhold Niebuhr. Even more contemporary people like John Rawls. There is, bizarrely enough, given that the American left is considered the more intellectual side, the place that dominates at America's fancy universities, it has actually been the side, I think, that has spent far less time trying to understand what it believes at the level of first principles. Conservatives have created a series of institutions over the past several decades dedicated to doing that. Liberals have not. So that you find in a classic debate between the left and right in the United States that the conservative starts this discussion by saying, "I believe that your rights come not from the state but from God, and I believe that the larger the state becomes, the more your freedom is diminished." And the liberal responds by saying, "Well, here's my 7-part plan for how to get to universal health care." And you saw that in the Kerry Bush campaign. One side talking about policy, the other talking about principle. So this book was my attempt to think about, at least on foreign policy, we could talk about domestic policy afterwards, what in fact I think the liberal foreign policy tradition is and what it means for today. And I want to start actually by talking about what I think the conservative tradition is, because I think it helps to put the liberal tradition in relief, and then to talk about how you might implement it today. I would contend that the fundamental divide on foreign policy for the last century between left and right in the United States has not been the willingness to use force. you can easily find moments of the last 100 years when, in fact, it's been the left in the United States that has been more willing to use force, at least the moderate left. Their conservatives were quite anti-military intervention in the 1920s, Presidents Harding, Coolidge, and Hoover. In the 1990s, the conservative Republican Congress was opposed to many of Clinton's military interventions. John F. Kennedy was quite a militaristic president. I think the fundamental divide is over the idea of interdependence. It is over the question of whether America should give other nations some influence over the way it exercises its power. It's over whether, to what degree, if at all, we should allow our prosperity and our security to be placed in the hands of others. Conservatives emphatically have said no. Liberals have been much more open to that idea. Conservative foreign policy, since America became a great power with World War I, has had two forms. One more isolationist, one what I would call imperialist. Conservative foreign policy famously in the 1920s, isolationist after America's rejection of the League of Nations. Conservative foreign policy in the 1990s, as I said, was also quite isolationist. On the other hand, there is a second conservative type that you can see running from the editors and founders of National Review in the 1950s through Barry Goldwater, through Ronald Reagan, really reaching its fruition with the policies of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, that I would consider imperialist. The isolationist conservative foreign policy essentially contends that other nations will have no influence over American foreign policy because we will disengage from the world. Imperialist conservative foreign policy contends that America will engage very actively with the world, but we will still allow other countries no real influence over the terms of that engagement. And that's why I think even though today's contemporary conservatives, people in the Bush administration, would disavow any intellectual connection to the isolationist conservatives of the 1920s or even of the 1990s, in fact, there is a fundamental connection between isolationist conservatism and what I would call imperialist or neo-imperialist conservatism. And it is this central point. It is the rejection of interdependence. America may disengage from the world. America may be extremely active in the world. But in either case, we will do it alone. We will do it unilaterally. We will allow international institutions and other nations very, very little influence over the terms of our interaction with the world. Since 9/11 in particular, the United States has demanded more and more of other countries. We have demanded that other countries change their behavior in a whole series of ways on anti-terrorism, on nuclear proliferation, on questions of democracy and human rights. And yet what has been so striking about that foreign policy is the disconnection between the radical unwillingness of the United States to allow other countries to have any reciprocal influence over our policies on questions of democracy, human rights, anti-terrorism, and anti-nuclear proliferation. And what I think is so remarkable about this is that it seems to me a perversion of the core conservative idea about human nature. Conservatism classically is pessimistic about human nature. Conservatives believe that human beings are sinful, that human beings are fallen. You cannot make human beings perfect, and the effort to try will create terrible things. That's the classic conservative contention. There's a lot of wisdom in it. And yet, the kind of conservatism that I think started to take root in the United States with the founding of the modern conservative movement, with the founding of the magazine, William F. Buckley's magazine, National Review, in the 1950s, and has really progressively taken over the Republican Party, maintains that extreme pessimism about human nature when it comes to the human nature of non-Americans. So, for instance, the behavior of non-Americans is usually considered to be selfish, self-interested, and manipulative. And therefore, it's a mistake to give non-Americans much influence over American behavior, because even if they say they're doing it in our interest or for noble, high-minded interests, they're probably not. They're probably doing it to try to weaken us in the world. That is the general conservative perspective. And yet, when it comes to perceptions of the human nature of Americans, conservatism has moved into this almost radically utopian vision in which our virtue is self-evident. We act only in accordance with the highest ideals of behavior. We are morally incorruptible. We can act without any, with minimal international constraints on our behavior, and indeed the executive can act with minimal domestic constraints on its behavior. But the more we are unconstrained, the more good we will do, because we are essentially angels who only act in accordance with some kind of universal moral law, such that. So you saw this, I think, the kind of reductive ad absurdum of this in George W. Bush's response to the Human Rights Watch report on America's anti-detainee prison system, Guantanamo Bay, most famously, when they detailed in great volume the degree to which America was violating many of the human rights conventions that, in fact, it had helped to author. And George W. Bush's response was, "That's ridiculous. Everybody knows that America stands for democracy and freedom around the world." And I think what he was really, the upshot of what he was saying was that democracy and freedom around the world are simply whatever America happens to be doing at the time. We define the meaning of those terms, and therefore it's axiomatic that whatever the United States is doing is in fact the promotion of democracy and human rights. The liberal tradition, I think, takes the idea of interdependence far more seriously. The idea that we have the right to make claims on the behavior of other nations, but our ability to make those claims is dependent, to some degree at least, on our willingness to allow other countries to make claims on our behavior as well. And I think the genesis of this idea starts with Woodrow Wilson, the beginning of America's emergence as a great power. In the second decade of the 20th century, Woodrow Wilson very much did not want to enter World War I. Woodrow Wilson, like most Americans, saw World War I as a typical European disaster that God, in His infinite wisdom, had allowed us to stay clear of because He had given us the Atlantic Ocean. One newspaper in Iowa after World War I broke out said that never had he appreciated Christopher Columbus more. But what Woodrow Wilson recognized over a series of years was that, in fact, America's fate was intertwined with Europe's fate, that a war between the great European powers threatened American commerce. The blockades that Britain and Germany were imposing threatened America's ability to prosper economically because we needed to trade with Europe. And beyond that, that the threat that one power, in this case Germany, would come to dominate the European landmass would threaten American security. Famously, embodied in the Zimmerman telegram, in which the Germans said to Mexico, "Come on our side in the European war and we'll help give you back Texas, Arizona, and New Mexico," which made Americans realize, in fact, that a German victory might have consequences for us. So Wilson, who was the kind of the founder of liberal foreign policy, I would argue, brings America into World War I. But when the war is over, he does something interesting. He neither tries to bring America back to a position of relative isolation for Europe, nor does he try to dominate Europe, to try to make America a kind of a new empire in Europe. That would have been impossible, but he doesn't even try. Instead, what he says is we need to set up certain rules for international relations that will bind the countries of Europe so they won't get into this mess again, but will also bind us. That there will be a set of principles having to do with free trade, freedom of the seas, national self-determination, open diplomacy, and we're going to ask the Europeans to abide by these principles, but we're going to abide by them as well. Which is to say, these principles are not simply whatever America happens to be doing at the time. They exist above and beyond American behavior as they exist above and beyond other nations' behavior, and we will allow other nations to have a role in defining the principles that govern them as well as us. This effort failed. Wilson's 14 points and then his League of Nations is famously rejected by the United States Senate, primarily because the United States Senate does not want to incur obligations to other countries. We don't want to have principles of American behavior that are going to be in which other countries will have some say over our decision making. So America doesn't join the League of Nations, famously. But this idea endures. And then in the 1930s, Americans again desperately want to avoid getting involved in another European war. But America is brought into World War II. And again, afterwards, Franklin Roosevelt, who had been an admirer of Woodrow Wilson, rather than America isolating itself, again, as it had after World War I, or rather than America trying to exercise imperial control in Europe, Franklin Roosevelt also goes back to this idea that America will try to help establish rules that will govern how other countries behave so that they won't produce another war or another depression, but that will govern us as well. This is the true genius, I think, of FDR's and Truman's foreign policy at the dawn of the Cold War. You think about the amount of power the United States had at the end of World War II. Europe was largely on its knees. Much of East Asia was on its knees. American power was probably more unconstrained than it had ever been. And yet Truman, and he said this consciously, Truman and FDR in a conscious way decided to self-consciously constrain American power, to give weaker nations some influence over our behavior, to allow the destroyed countries of Europe some influence in defining the institutions that would govern not only their behavior, but our behavior, in the idea that if we did that, we could make our power legitimate in their eyes. We could convince them that America's massive newfound power was not only good for us, but good for them as well. George Kennan, who was the architect of Truman's early containment policies, said, the Soviet Union is an empire. It doesn't look like an empire, like the empires of old, but really it is an empire because it governs in Eastern Europe based on coercion and brute force. And empires, while they look strong or brittle, they always break from the periphery. And indeed, as early as the early 1950s, the Poles start rising up against Soviet power, because the Soviets can't convince them that their power is good for the Poles. But Kennan says, if we give weaker nations some influence over our power, if we can avoid becoming an empire, we can develop an alliance system in Western Europe that is based more on persuasion and consent than on coercion, and it will endure long after the Soviet Union is a distant memory. This idea that America should allow other nations some influence over its behavior as the price for us having influence over their behavior. This idea that moral progress in the world requires some degree of moral reciprocity, it seems to me, is based on a more consistent idea of human nature than the conservative one. Liberals have famously historically been more optimistic about human nature, more optimistic about the prospect of human reason bringing human progress. And liberals remain more optimistic, I would argue, about human nature in general. But the important part, it seems to me, of the liberal foreign policy tradition is the universality of its views about human nature. It does not argue that human beings become different animals when they leave the 50 states of America. It argues that this optimism about human nature is true for Americans as well, that we believe that we can act cooperatively and that we believe that other nations can act cooperatively. We believe that we can act idealistically and we believe that other nations can act idealistically. Not that different kinds of regimes don't matter. Of course, they matter a great deal. Some governments represent their people far more than others. But it maintains at least the idea that other nations, in fact, can strive towards a moral law as well as us. So let me just try to say something about what I think this means for today. I think the story of our time is the story of the spreading of this idea of interdependence from Europe and the Americas and the developed world to the entire world. You know, Wilson and FDR, when they were thinking about interdependence, were really thinking primarily about America's interdependence with Europe and perhaps to some lesser degree with Japan and East Asia. But they did not take the idea of interdependence as their prism for how America would deal with the then colonized world. In the colonized world, what we call the developing world, they basically thought that America could either be isolationist or imperialist, that we didn't have binding obligations to other nations, that those nations could not, in fact, make demands upon us. I think that is, in some ways, the genesis of how America got into the Vietnam War, because it essentially became a colonial power following the French in Southeast Asia, and the very principles of interdependence that governed America's relationship with Europe and to some degree with Japan were absent from the way we treated Vietnam. In a globalized world today, however, it is no longer just the most powerful countries in the world, the richest countries in the world, the Germans, the Russias, the Japans, that can be a threat to the United States. The revolution in technology, in communication and transport means that now America is interdependent with even the most backward, poorest countries in the world. No one in the United States believed on September 10th, 2001, that anything that happened in a country as remote and backward as Afghanistan would ever really matter to us. or that a village in China that Americans have never heard of can incubate a bird flu that creates a kind of fear of global pandemic around the world, or that the collapse of the Thai banking system can almost send the world into global recession in the late 1990s. In a globalized world in which America is interdependent not just with powerful countries, but indeed with the weakest countries of the world, we have a greater interest than ever before, it seems to me, in how those countries govern themselves. Because if they can provide public health, if they don't massively degrade the environment, if they can educate their young people so they don't go to extremist madrasas and become terrorists, if they can regulate their financial systems, they don't produce the pathology that in a globalized world can spread to our shores, even from the poorest parts of the world, far faster than ever before. But, and again, this is the critical point, the critical reciprocity that is at the heart of interdependence. In a globalized world, America also has to recognize that if other nations can be a greater threat to us than ever before, we can be a greater threat to them. That in a smaller world, what we do, our contribution to global warming, our sale of small arms which fuel civil conflict in the third world, our pursuit of a whole new class of nuclear weapons which undermines the IAEA regime, our treatment of terrorists in ways that in fact fuels Islamic radicalism that destabilizes other countries, those are all ways in which we are not upholding our obligations to other nations. That if other nations have increased obligations to us, we also have increased obligations to them. The way historically America has tried to respond to interdependence, the way America has tried to hold other countries to a higher standard while allowing them to hold us to a higher standard as well, has been through international institutions and international law. The whole raft of international institutions that were built at the end of World War II, the UN, the IMF, the World Bank, what became the World Trade Organization, slightly later, NATO, all of these institutions have atrophied in a globalized world. All of them have not kept pace with the massive changes, both on the security and economic side, that we have seen in recent years. And that's why it seems to me that the great challenge for American liberal foreign policy in the coming decades, the thing that the next Democratic president, I would hope Republican president, but certainly Democratic president, will have to address himself or herself to in a fundamental way, beyond just crisis management, although there will be a great deal of that, will be the rebuilding of the international institutions that once facilitated interdependence, and the building of new international institutions to deal with new challenges like climate change and public health and anti-terrorism. To build institutions in which the America, can, with its close allies like Britain and Australia, can use as a vehicle to demand that other countries hold themselves to a higher standard so they don't breed the pathologies that can threaten us, but also, and this is critical, we cede some degree of our own sovereignty to allow other nations to hold us to a higher standard as well. And it seems to me the more we do that, the more we can respond to the crisis of legitimacy that faces American power around the world today, and the closer we can come to the historic dream of liberal foreign policy, which is the dream that America can be a superpower without being an empire, that American power can benefit not only us, but other people as well. That paradoxically, by recognizing our common humanity, by recognizing that Americans are no better, are no different than anyone else, paradoxically, precisely because we do that, it allows America to be a nation that can astonish and inspire the world. Thanks very much.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.